This session, I couldn't help thinking of how much I liked the movie The Wizard of Oz when I was a kid. And the part where Judy Garland, or Dorothy, is tapping her feet together and saying, "There's no place like home, there's no place like home." And most of us probably, through most of our life, have probably thought, yeah, maybe there isn't any place like home. And then at some point there may be something that happens that makes us ask some questions about whether that was really the case. And I want to invite people tonight to maybe do that in a spirit of love and grace, I guess, which is what we're going to be doing all weekend and focusing on. I think the home that we're born and raised in, or what the clinical psychology kind of people talk about, they call it our family of origin, or our FO, or FO, or whatever, is a tremendously powerful experience for all of us. And the impact of that experience is not restricted to our childhood. I think the way we see ourselves, other people, how we look at the world, is shaped in the setting of that home sweet home. And the views we develop there, I think, stay with us throughout life. At some point, most of us leave our place called home, at least physically. Some of us take a little longer, maybe emotionally, to leave. And I think even if we put the Cascade Mountains between ourself and our home, it's still kind of with us. Or maybe if we never even return home again, we probably continue to reenact in some ways the dynamics of that home sweet home. In the new homes or the families that we establish, be they our work or our community or our network, somehow we probably see that mirrored back to us, and suddenly what we thought we were running away from, or maybe escaping, or closing a door on, as somebody said this afternoon, is suddenly right there before us again, in a different kind of way. Something might have happened to us a long time ago. It might have happened more than once. It might have hurt us. We protected ourselves the only way we knew how. We might still be protecting ourselves. It may not be working for us anymore. So what happens when we ask the question, home sweet home, or was it? And why should we bother to do it? There are bigger problems in the world. People are starving. Some people don't even have a family to ask the question of. I know my own experience was that I thought everything was a Leave It to Beaver family for us, until I was about, I don't know, 25, and I happened to go to a conference in Minneapolis sponsored by the Johnson Institute, which is a family-centered place, and there was a guy who got up and started talking about some family dynamics, and I kind of sat there the whole time with my stomach turning and my eyes opening and saying, this guy's talking about my family, or he's talking about me. And suddenly I had different glasses on when I started to look at my siblings, when I started to look at my parents, when I started to look at the church, when I started to look at a lot of things that were a part of what I thought was this real Leave It to Beaver family. And I guess, you know, in some ways, I'd like to think I gained something from putting on those different glasses. I'd like to think that maybe I have been able to look at some of the patterns I took from that family and at least had a light bulb turn on. Maybe I haven't been able to change some of those things, but I think I have some clues into why I end up sometimes in the interactions that I do and maybe the relationships, the anxieties that I have or whatever. But I'd invite all of us this weekend as we kind of go between looking at the inner healing and the outer healing of the earth and the world to ask that question, why? I think today there's millions of folks asking it. The self-help sections of bookstores are probably the biggest they've ever been. Our own libraries might be as big as they've ever been on that question. Some people are asking it differently than Freud did, though, and they're not doing it on the couch. They're doing it in different ways. And some people have called this sort of effort or this new big movement adult children. And since I've come to Holden 3 years ago and begun to use that term along with a lot of other people who've come through and used it, people ask a lot of questions about what is this adult children and who didn't grow up in a dysfunctional family. Well, who are they? And what are some of the troubles that plague adult children, so to speak? And where do they live now? What kind of problems do they have? Who are these people anyway? And who are they that they're so bold to ask the question of, was my home such a home, sweet home?
We are people who hit age 28 or 39 or 47 and suddenly find that something is wrong that we can no longer fix by ourselves. It may coincide with the normal life crisis, but its intensity and accompanying pain and confusion suggest that there are adult-child issues beneath the surface.
We are people who gaze at our peers on the street or at a party and say to ourselves, I wish I could be like her or him.
Or we say, if only he knew what was really going on inside me, he'd be appalled.
We are people who love our spouses and care deeply for our children, but find ourselves growing distant, detached, and fearful in these relationships.
Or we feel that everything in our lives is perfect until our sons or daughters become chemically dependent, bulimic, or run away from home or attempt suicide.
We are the chemically addicted, the sexually addicted, and the eating disorder.
We are the migraine sufferers, the exercise fanatics, and the high achievers with troubled marriages.
We are the social stars who feel terribly lonely amidst our wealth of friends.
Some of us grew up in chaotic families and were weaned on alcoholism, incest, and physical, emotional, and spiritual abuse.
Some of us are especially paralyzed now because the dysfunction we experienced was so subtle that we can't even begin to put a finger on what it was that happened to us.
Some of us were compared to a brother or sister who did well in school.
Others were led to believe that we could only have worth and value if we became plumbers or doctors, electricians, lawyers, or psychologists.
Many of us were emotionally neglected because no one was physically there for us, or because they were there for us with material things, but were absent emotionally.
Some were spoiled and smothered out of misguided love, seduced to stay in the nest years after our friends had gone out into the world and begun their adult lives.
Many of us are afraid of people, especially authority figures.
Others of us frighten people, especially our loved ones, and demand that our loved ones live in our isolated worlds, controlled completely by us.
We are people who despise religion or who despise atheism.
We let others use and abuse us, or we use and abuse others.
We are people who have only anger, or only sadness, or only fear, or only smiles.
We try so hard that we lose, or try so little that we never live life at all.
We are men and women who look picture perfect.
We are on emotional roller coasters, or in emotional vacuums.
We smile by slamming the kitchen cabinet shut because we're really angry. Or we slam the cabinet angrily when we're really sad.
We abuse ourselves, but take care of everyone else.
When we are unhappy, we are terribly afraid to acknowledge it for fear that someone will find out that we are human, or even worse, that we are even here at all.
We can make love, but we can't get emotionally close, or we can't make love at all.
We constantly watch others to try to find out what's okay, what isn't.
We feel less than some and better than others, but we rarely feel like we belong.
We get stuck in lives our hearts never chose.
We hang on to the past, fear the future, and feel anxious in the present.
We work ourselves to death for unknown purposes.
We fear God, or we expect God to do it all for us.
We get into friendships that we can't get out of.
We get hooked on things.
We project our inner conflicts onto our children.
We are embarrassed about our bodies.
We suffer as much as we can.
We sacrifice our dignity for false security.
We wish for things instead of going out and getting what we want or need.
We hope for the best, expect the worst, and never enjoy the moment.
We run away when we fall in love, or we abandon ourselves for the relationship.
We smother those we love, we crush those we love, or both.
We were sexually abused by someone when we were 5 years old, but blame ourselves, telling ourselves that we should have known better at age 5.
Some of us had a parent who was chronically ill when we were growing up.
Some of us had a parent who was mentally ill when we were growing up.
Some of us had no parents at all when we were growing up.
We are survivors who deep down inside pray that someday life will be more than just mere survival.
We are lovers of life whose home sweet home experience might have locked a part of us up, waiting to be set free, to make peace with that experience. There are a lot of people who've experienced in an earlier environment that challenged their childhood experience. And the result was probably not all bad. The consequences may have even given us some really important survival life skills and some more memories as well. There is some connection between our adult relationships and how well we learn to deal with the forces that are in our family of origin or our home sweet home. I'd like you all now to ask yourself the question of home sweet home, or was it, by responding to three questions, either by drawing or writing them. And we may not have enough handouts for everybody, but I've written them out. You may have to share if you have notebook paper next to you, or if somebody else has some, if there's not enough. Take about 5 minutes or so, maybe longer. People need writing instruments. Thank you.
I have some more right here.
You have some more?
Here's a couple of pen and pencils. Anybody need one? Anybody else?
Yes. Thank you.
You got one, Chris?
Yeah.
Is anyone else standing? If you're anything like me, sometimes I look at it and think, God, that wasn't so bad. And then the next minute I'll be reading something or looking at it and think, boy, we were really screwed up at times. And being like it has to be one way or the other. And some of you may know sort of more about the history of how the whole adult children sort of movement exploded. I know in working in alcoholism that around 1980 or 81, a woman by the name of Janet Woiditz wrote a book called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I think it was like on the New York bestseller list for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, maybe almost all of the 80s, it seemed like. And, you know, people grabbed that book, and it was especially geared towards people who grew up in alcoholic families, but suddenly other people were reading that book and saying, God, my parents were an alcoholic, but I can sure relate to that. And people were saying, I can't say my parents were alcoholic, but something was wrong, and I can sort of connect with this information. And so the movement changed or sort of expanded from just being called Adult Children of Alcoholics to Adult Children from Dysfunctional Families to... And in many ways, I was one of those people when it first started, they said, they always called it ACOA. Some places it still is. And I used to say, do I have to admit that my father was an agronomist to belong to him? He was an alcoholic. But, you know, I thought, gosh, there's some of this I can relate to, you know. And I think it sort of opened the door for people to begin to even acknowledge, you know, family dysfunction. Maybe to the extreme. I don't know. Maybe we're going to start to swing the other way a little bit. It'll be interesting to see. And I hope we maybe can even talk about that this weekend as well. But some of those characteristics that began to be developed, I think she developed a list of about, I don't know, 9, 11, or 12, something like that, of certain characteristics that research seemed to say could be seen in children who grew up in this particular kind of family. And I had to laugh sometimes. I didn't give it a lot of credence because there was one of them, I think, that said something about either sees things through to completion or never seems to get things done. And I thought, well, who's excluded from that? You know, it was so all-inclusive that, you know, anybody could say, well, oh, that's me, you know. But I think that some of the work, I think it's moved and expanded, and I think people have done some really good things in this area. So I just want to spend some time with that, and then we'll wrap it up and go to snack bar. I think that we can look at some of the behavior patterns that were mentioned in those voices that came from around the room and make some note about them. I think a lot of the characteristics or the struggles or whatever you want to call the issues that we take into adulthood have a lot to do with part of our denial system, part of a way of emotionally trying to maintain some blinders, and they kind of allow us in some ways to live one kind of life while convincing ourselves and other people that we really have a very different kind of life. And some people will talk about the elephant in the living room that maybe in their own family it was never talked about, and yet we all knew that there was this gigantic elephant in the middle of the room, and we walked around it, and we
all knew it was there. We probably even cleaned up after it. But we never said out loud, we've got this big elephant in the middle of our room, and never acknowledged it. And we can't help but grow out of that and take that into, you know, future kind of settings. So I think the element of denial is one thing to note. I think a lot of those survival patterns, those lists of things, give us the illusion that we're in control, maybe from a life situation where we didn't have control, where things felt really chaotic. And so I think we struggle to have that as an adult. But in many ways, those behaviors are in fact maybe better indicators that that what we've really done is given up maybe healthy control in our lives to something outside of ourselves, be it shopping or money or drugs or sex or relationships or whatever we work, achieving, accomplishing, consuming. But in some way, I think those patterns give us some illusion that we do have some kind of control. That's important in our culture today. I think it's also important to remember that a lot of those behaviors started out as a really normal response to an abnormal situation. There are some people who argue today that mental illness is that. That people get mentally ill who are having a real normal response to an abnormal culture and environment. But in some ways, what we did in those life stress, at least if we perceived it that way, it may not have been stressful to the person next door or a sibling. You may even know from your siblings that they look at your family situation very differently than what you do. But the perception is kind of what's important. We perceived it as stressful. And so our reaction to that, our response, was very normal. And it's normal and logical and reasonable for a child to want to protect themselves in some kind of way, just like an infection. Also, I think they form as a way of protecting us from a pain that we had no say over. We didn't choose to have it there. And it's a way to sort of protect, and sometimes the longer we protect, the more adept we get at denying, and it becomes some kind of a vicious cycle. We protect, and then we cover up, and they go hand in hand. And I think, as we talked about this afternoon, or somebody alluded to, I think a lot of those behaviors are about the freezing of emotions. I think many people this weekend might end up saying, when you leave on Monday, I kind of felt like I thawed out this weekend. I know when we used to work with people in treatment, that was often the way they described the process. I feel like I'm kind of melting or thawing out inside after being kind of frozen and pretty stuck. I think sometimes we take pride in how other people see us, either as the strong one, or the rebel, or the cute one, and we stay there. And it becomes a way to maintain an image that's probably really not us. And maybe on the inside there's a part of us that's dying, because we maybe feel that nobody really knows who we are, and we probably don't either. I think it's the behavior patterns are about intimacy. They're about relationship struggles. Who doesn't have those? But I think the kind of people that we are, we place a high value on relationship. And when they feel like they've gone astray, it weighs on us. It's a burden, and you feel that. And thus, a lot of the patterns are about shame. We know in the kind of circles that most of us travel, in religious circles, shame is a real key word. I think the shame is about being found out, about being discovered, about feeling naked in front of others, perhaps being laughed at, criticized, or rejected. Some of the more common things that come out of homes that we maybe are asking the question about whether it was sweet or not. Addictions, which is kind of a buzzword too these days. It's been expanded from what used to be a physiological addiction to everything now. And people commonly use the word to describe all kinds of patterns. It was a narrow sense, and now it's more broadly talked about in terms of work and love and TV and religion and all kinds of things. And some of the key elements of addiction in a more true to the clinical sense had to do with preoccupation and increased tolerance for things, a loss of control over the behavior despite your efforts to try to control it, the withdrawal, the sneaking, the denial of it, the blaming, the mood swings, the blackouts, rigid attitudes, perhaps the loss of values that one might have had before the addiction got out of control. And as many of you know and alluded to also earlier, just because you don't drink doesn't mean that you're free from addiction. You can have all the traits of an addict, the denial, the discomfort, the intimacy, all of those kinds of things without necessarily.